Shift left testing, which simply means beginning testing as early as practical in the life cycle, is one of the most important and widely discussed trends within the software testing community. What is less widely known, both inside and outside the testing community, is that testers can employ four fundamentally different approaches to shift testing to the left. In today's podcast, we will explore these four approaches and which one might be most appropriate for your organization. Welcome to the SEI Podcast Series, a production of the Carnegie Mellon University Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center sponsored by the U.S. Department of Defense and operated by Carnegie Mellon University. A transcript of today's podcast is posted on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcast. My name is Suzanne Miller. I'm a principal researcher here at the SEI, and today I am pleased to introduce you to my colleague Don Firesmith, the genius behind these four approaches, and a fellow principal researcher here at the SEI. Today, we are going to talk about Don's research into the four approaches for shifting testing to the left. First, a little bit about Don, who has been a guest on our show previously to talk about his other research in software testing. At the SEI, Don provides practical guidance, for example, with regard to requirements engineering, system and software architectures, and testing, to help program offices acquire software-intensive systems. He also develops and maintains new technologies such as methods for engineering safety and security requirements, as well as assessing the quality of system requirements and architectures. He is also the author of countless journal articles on software and systems engineering, as well as 7 technical books, including, most recently, Common System and Software Testing Pitfalls. Don, thank you for joining us today. So how does shift left testing differ from traditional testing?
Well, traditional testing, and by this I mean testing of 15, 20, 25 years ago, was testing pretty much at the end. Mm-hmm. You'd have a waterfall life cycle. You do your requirements, your architecture, your design and implementation. And only when you were done with all of that work would you finally get around to doing your testing. And even there, if you look at the right side of the traditional V model, which starts with unit testing, then integration testing, and up to systems testing, back in those days, a lot of people would start right off with system level testing. They wouldn't really do much in the way mm-hmm. of unit testing
we'll
or
catch
integration
it in system testing.
Yeah, we'll catch it in system testing. And often this was testing at the very end, which had the problem that if you found anything, you often didn't have time to fix it before your delivery date. Shift left testing, on the other hand, is essentially moving testing to the left on the development life cycle, left on the project timeline. And therefore, what we're doing here is moving testing earlier so that we're not waiting until the system is produced to start testing it, but we're starting to do much more in the way of unit testing and integration testing and performing these activities much earlier, beginning to do testing at the very beginning of the project.
And we're not just talking about defining the tests at the beginning of the project, because that's been done for years, but we're talking about executing tests at the beginning of the project.
That's exactly right. That is a key distinction. In the past, the left side of the V was there for planning and doing some initial preparation work, and you might actually develop some test cases early on, but you weren't actually testing anything because back in those days, there was nothing really to test mm-hmm. at that point in time. Shift left testing is based on other trends in the software development world, which has moved a lot of the rest of the development effort earlier in the project. So we started doing detailed design work earlier, we started doing implementation earlier, we started doing integration earlier, and therefore we had something that we could start testing much earlier.
Cool. So why does it matter? Why does shift left testing matter? What are its benefits? And are there any drawbacks to this approach?
The benefits of shift left testing include things like the testers become involved earlier in the development process. That makes it more likely that testing is going to get integrated with the rest of the development process. And it's also going to make it more likely that testing receives the resources it needs to get done properly. Testing executable models can be used to identify mistakes in the requirements, the architecture, and the design. And this is done then before significant effort's been wasted in implementing these in software and hardware. Emphasizing unit and integration testing over system-level GUI testing also makes it easier to perform white box or structure-based testing. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier to achieve the planned levels of code coverage, and it also makes it easier to perform debugging, including identifying, localizing, fixing, and regression testing the defects.
Okay.
It also provides more time to fix these defects found by testing, thereby decreasing the likelihood that these defects are going to get postponed to later increments or versions of the system. That helps us avoid creating a bow wave of technical debt that sinks projects if it grows too large.
So these are benefits that are very important. A lot of these have schedule implications and they have cost implications. So why wouldn't everybody do it this way?
Actually, certain types of shift left testing are becoming extremely popular, sort of the standard way of doing things now.
And certainly within the Agile community, having testers on the development team from the very beginning is pretty much a standard practice. So there's
Absolutely.
Some parts of the community that have really embraced this kind of approach. But clearly not everyone has, or else we wouldn't be talking about this.
Yeah, a lot of people, especially on smaller programs, smaller companies, haven't really made the transition yet. And one of the types of shift left testing, the testing of executable requirements and architecture mm-hmm. models, is just beginning to be performed now because there's not much in the way of good tools mm-hmm. for performing the testing, right. and a lot of people just aren't aware that it's an option.
And executable models, although they've been used in Europe for many years, are really just becoming a thing in the United
right.
States engineering community. So the existence of those models, you've got to train the engineers how to do the models, and you've got to train the testers how to interact with the models. So there are some barriers to that particular type
right.
of testing that exists today, but maybe not forever.
So
through your research, you've identified these four approaches to shift left testing, and so why don't you describe each one of them for us briefly?
Okay, traditional shift left testing is basically moving from the upper right side of the V to the lower right side of the V model. What we're really talking about is moving the emphasis off of the system level GUI testing okay. with things like record and playback tools down to greater emphasis on unit testing, mm-hmm. integration testing, API level testing.
Okay.
And this kind of testing, transition to this kind of shift left testing is largely completed amongst professional testers.
Okay, what's the second?
Well, refer to the second type of shift left testing as incremental shift left testing. Instead of having a single V model for a single waterfall lifecycle, mm-hmm. what people will often do is realize that a system is going to go through various major increments. And so, for example, if a system is going to go through four increments, then you'll have four, if you will, V models.
Right.
And the testing that occurs on the first two or three of those V models happens before that testing would have happened had you had just a single waterfall
sure.
life cycle. So it's a moving to the left
By breaking down the system
into rather large increments.
Okay. Then and the third?
The third you already mentioned, and that is agile testing and even more so testing
DevOps.
In DevOps.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to the second type, but here it's a matter of size and duration of the increment. What we'll be doing here is doing sort of a continual integration and testing where you can look at it as many small Vs instead
yeah.
of a much.
So I talk to people about the incremental model being like a W,
mm-hmm.
and then I talk about Agile being a sawtooth, right?
Exactly.
It's smaller increments, but lots of increments.
Yeah, and in fact, not only do you have lots of increments, so a great number of these increments have their testing happening before mm-hmm. they would have, even with an incremental approach, The other thing that often happens on large projects is you will have multiple teams working on different subsystems, different right. major parts of it. And so consequently, that also then tends to move the testing on those increments earlier in the development process.
And one of the things we're seeing in Agile is even specialty testing, like information assurance, is also moving to the left, where they're getting more engaged in the individual iterations instead of waiting for releases or waiting for a final development.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just unit testing and integration testing and system testing here. All of the different kinds of specialty engineering testing, whether it's security, safety, reliability, capacity testing, load testing, performance testing, you name it, all these can happen in an incremental manner.
Right.
And even though a lot of the specialty engineering, the quality attribute level testing really does occur at the system level, and you can't finalize the testing until
right.
the entire system's built.
But you still learn
you
a lot
start,
about the system.
Yes, you learn a lot about the system, and you can definitely start a lot of that testing mm-hmm. earlier on. And once again, the earlier you find the defects, mm-hmm. the more time you have to fix them.
And one of the aspects of the shift left in any of these models is that you're testing increments earlier, and so there's not as much code, so it can be easier to analyze when you find a defect. Where is it? You know, where did it come in? It's a shorter time frame. So many of the activities that actually take a lot of time when you do all your testing at the end don't take as much time per defect, and so that's got to be a benefit.
It's definitely a benefit, perhaps less so to the traditional tester who's finding the defects, but certainly to the developer
yeah.
who has to understand what the defect is, localize where it's at, figure out how to properly fix it, and then fix it so that you can then rerun some
right.
regression tests.
And so you don't break anything else. That's always
exactly.
important, one of the important aspects. Okay, so then there's one more model, which happens to be
the model-based shift-left testing.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
This is, in fact, sort of cutting edge when it comes to shift-left testing. As we mentioned before, the advantage is that we can start finding defects in our models.
Yeah.
Now, we have in the past found defects in the models by things like reviews and inspections and static analysis mm-hmm. of the models and so on. But there's really no reason why we can't also use testing if the model is executable.
Sure. It,
the model really becomes, if you will, code at the next higher level of abstraction.
Yes.
So once that you have that kind of a model, it makes no sense not to start testing it. The real issue, however, is that most of the tools that currently exist supporting testing, they're all organized around code.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you don't necessarily need tools to do this kind of testing. You can actually, if you will, execute the model using the wetware computer between your ears. You can go through...
Oh, that old thing.
Yeah, that old thing. You can use sequence diagrams or activity diagrams or state charts or things like
mm-hmm.
that. And by executing those in your head, by walking through the models, if you will, you can actually see that each one of those sequence diagrams is a test case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So you can do different things to actually execute in your head and then translate that into executing mm-hmm. with the model itself if the tools are available to do that.
Yes, and there are other kinds of tools that you can use. One of our customers, for example, takes concept of operations and uses nothing more than flash animation to animate those concepts. And then each one of those animations, the storyboards as they call them, becomes a test case that can be demonstrated
yeah,
in front
yeah.
of a subject matter expert who can then act as the oracle of the test,
okay.
telling you whether or not the model is correct.
That's a very cool way of doing it.
Yes.
I never thought of that one. All right. So so what is the current state of the practice in this arena? We've talked about the executable model testing being kind of on the cutting edge, and we've talked a little bit about the sort of traditional being almost a complete transition. But it sounds like there are still some barriers that we need to think about in this area.
I think it largely is a case of whether or not you're talking about an Agile or DevOps type application or not, on whether or not you make it to that third level.
Mm-hmm.
Practically anyone who is building a large, complex system is at the very least developing that incrementally with fairly large increments. So if you're doing, you know, that kind of incremental development, then you are, you know, getting the benefits of that second level of shift left testing. The real issue, I think, in my mind is that while people are starting to make this shift, definitely in the Agile community, there's not everyone quite, you know, on the testing side of it realizes what's going on here and the benefit. And then when it comes to DevOps, that is very popular when we're talking about software applications running in data centers.
IT applications, MIS,
where you don't have to worry about hardware. Where we don't see the DevOps testing version, and for that matter, even to a certain extent, the Agile testing as much, is when we're talking about embedded systems, when we're talking about things like weapon systems or aircraft
and
cars
and
things like that.
That's a more challenging environment for...
Exactly.
But we do, I mean, I'm working with a customer in the DoD space that we're very excited about because we're doing scaled Agile kinds of activities with them, and their testers are in every class that we're offering. There's at least one tester in every class, and they're very, they're anxious to get started in this new way. And I found that to be very positive, that this very complex embedded system, the testers are there with the developers, you know, trying to make this happen.
What I tend to see is that the software testers tend to be very interested in it and work to incrementally develop and test the software.
Right.
What I've yet to see is very much in the way of systems testers in the Agile community adopting shift left. And for that matter, the same sort of thing applies when we're talking about operational testers in the DevOps community.
Operational testing is tough. There's still, especially in the DoD environment, there's a lot of disablers, I'll call it, to them participating in some of this the way they might want to actually.
Right.
But the DevOps, I can't remember exactly where I read it, but I know something came across my feed. You know, the latest thing is Dev Test Ops. So they may be hearing you.
There are a fair number of people out there who are talking about testing in the DevOps world. But once again, the emphasis is very much on the MIS applications so far. And one of the active areas of research I'm working with some people here in the SEI is looking at testing in the DevOps world in the embedded application space, in the systems testing world.
Sure.
Something that is just starting once again, but it's not, no one really knows how to do it well yet.
Okay. Well, that we will look forward to the results of that research. So these four approaches, there's some obvious connections. If you're doing a big waterfall kind of development, then you're going to need to apply the first approach because that's the one that... But are there some other heuristics about what kinds of organizations respond to the other approaches to shift left testing?
Well, I would say that every organization benefits from the shift down to the unit and integration testing and the API level testing instead of waiting and doing all of their testing at the user interface level. So that's one that seems to be good for everybody, regardless of what you're doing. Now, when we're talking about a large system being developed for a customer where you're pretty much required to provide quite large increments at a time, you may be doing Agile testing inside the development organization, but then it becomes harder to do the Agile, the third level of testing, when it comes all the way across to involving the customer. So in that case, what you'll often see is in the software side of the fence, you'll have DevOps or agile testing, possibly DevOps testing, but you'll have the incremental testing when it comes to operational testing and, you know, the overall system as a whole. Now, when it comes to the fourth version, and that is the executable model testing, there's really no reason why you shouldn't start researching that now. As I mentioned before, with either, you know, doing manual testing, if you will, using your own brain as the test environment, or, you know, using some simple kind of tool like Flash animation, or for that matter, using some of the tools now that work on modeling languages like ADL or SysML or UML, you can start doing that level of testing. The one thing I would say, though, is that's going to require some training. That's going to require some thought. That is a mind shift that is quite large, because most people, when they think testing, they think I'm testing software or I'm testing the system, and they don't realize that if you've got something executable, you can test it and you don't have to wait until the software exists. There is also another interesting thing that makes this fourth type of testing less common. There are some people within the Agile community who see the so many, as you say, the sawtooth version of the V model happening so often that some of them do not see much reason to do much in the way of modeling. Requirements modeling or architecture modeling. True. And therefore, they don't see a value in investing in testing the models that they don't want to develop in the first place. I would say if we're dealing with something that is safety critical, security critical, truly business critical, and you're dealing with something large and complex, it makes sense to do a certain amount of requirements modeling and architecture modeling up front before you get into the agile increments. And if you do that, then there's no reason not to start testing
and
those models.
And some of the scaling frameworks are much more emphatic about intentional architecture. And when you get to intentional architecture, then you can get into modeling.
Right. So. I think there's been a wide recognition amongst many people in the Agile community that that kind of modeling definitely has its place. You don't necessarily want to do more than is cost effective to do, but doing none is often not the wisest course either.
So you talked about doing some of the shift left testing in the embedded software community. What are some other areas that you hope to explore in the future?
Well, yes, definitely in the hardware world and the system world. I'm not even sure that the term embedded system adequately covers my thinking there, because I truly think that what we're dealing with when we're talking about automated vehicles, robotics, aircraft, just any of these large systems, software is an extremely important part of it, but what our customers are buying, what they're acquiring are in fact systems, you know, in this case. And therefore, looking at how testing is done at that system level is an important issue. And then the other, I think, really big thing is right now we have this major separation between developmental testing and operational testing. And while the commercial world is integrating these two with DevOps, we're just not seeing that happen yet when we're talking about true systems in the Department of Defense. And yet, there clearly are benefits of integrating DT and OT.
Sure.
We just need to understand better how to do it.
And how to disable the disablers.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Another related topic is simulation. One of the key areas that we deal with these large systems is modeling and simulation. For example, when you're doing operational testing, you can't necessarily afford to have dozens of aircraft and ground sites and satellites and everything involved in these systems of systems. So people are starting, you know, to do an awful lot of simulations involved in the operational tests. And once we have simulation tools, those also support testing directly because the simulation is an executable model.
Right. And once it's been validated, then you have confidence that the simulation, if the simulation works, it actually is also validated. So you've got a chain of evidence there that the simulation models
And the
provide.
Simulation then becomes an oracle, a test oracle.
Very good. Very good. Well, this is very good work, and as one of the people researching Agile enablers and barriers, I'm looking forward to some of the results of some of this that apply to Agile testing, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Listeners who want to know more about your work can obviously start with the recent book on commonly occurring system and software testing pitfalls. It's essentially a how-not-to book, and we need non-examples as much as we need examples. It will help you understand, recognize, and avoid making common testing mistakes. There are also several testing-related blogs on the SEI website. And finally, there are some testing groups on LinkedIn where you can engage in often great discussions on important testing issues. And I imagine, Don, you're one of the people that contribute to those on a regular basis.
That I do.
So we will include links to these kinds of resources in our transcript. And I want to thank you again for joining us, and I want to thank our listeners for joining us today. This podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts and on Carnegie Mellon University's iTunes U site. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thank you for listening.